Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Art Sear, John Kochelko, Charles Lipson, and John McDonough. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. If you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it's beyondthebeltway.com, where you can listen and watch these programs if you miss them each and every week. And we have a new email or a Twitter account, which is @Dumo, @DUMO, if you want to tweet us a question. Tonight, for the next 2 hours, we're going to be continuing our discussion that began last week about the release of Bo Bergdahl and the controversy that has surrounded it. We were one of the first national shows to address that last week. The story continues to grow. The brouhaha is just exploding in Washington, D.C., and we will continue our discussion about that, but also weaving into our story the commemoration of the 70th anniversary of D-Day and Normandy and what happened at that beach 70 years ago and really the liberation of Europe by U.S. And Allied soldiers. We're going to be talking about that as the program this evening because so much of the broader discussion is soldiers and responsibility and honor and duty to their country. And we're going to start talking about that. Art Sear, you are a veteran served in the Korean War. Is that correct?
Actually, it was the Civil War, Bruce.
Oh, no.
I was in the Army during the Vietnam War.
What is your response to the trade of Bergdahl for five Taliban terrorists? What's your take on that?
Well, my take is we always give a priority historically. I'm glad you brought up history. Thank you very much. As well as currently, and a high priority in this country, especially to getting our prisoners back. In that sense, it was congruent with mindful of the controversy, congruent with the way presidents have acted through history.
Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago, was the price too high to pay for one soldier?
It was, in my opinion. The price was too high. The process was bad. They were supposed to and should have spoken with the heads of the intelligence committees and some of the senior people. And the victory dance that they did in the White House was, in my opinion, a kind of appalling, especially when you consider how many soldiers were left behind by what now seems to be a deserter, and the White House should have known that.
John Kochelko, John, your opinion.
I think a wiser and more competent president would not have associated himself immediately with the story until all the facts were known. I think it's just another example of the general incompetence of this administration in terms of foreign and defense policy. And I think five major terrorist figures for one individual who has been accused of many things, and we don't know what his culpability is, but certainly he is less than Sergeant York. I think that's a fair statement to make. I think that it was simply not a congruent trade. You know, 50 years ago, John Kennedy traded one major Soviet intelligence officer, Rudolf Abel, and we got back one American operative, Francis Gary Powers, which I think indicates that JFK was capable of driving a much better bargain than Barack Obama.
John McDonough joins us. Your comment, John?
Well, it did seem to have a kind of mission accomplished quality about it, didn't
exactly.
it? Exactly. At least he didn't do it in a flight suit. But other than that, as far as the price paid, like a lot of these things, it's hard to know whether the price was worth the value until, in my case at least, I have a few more facts to work with on this. This young man seems to have been tried and convicted in the press in the last week, and I think it might be a little premature, but I don't discount the accusations. I just think they're still to be evaluated.
But the White House certainly should have known.
Yeah, right.
They certainly should have known of the background. There was a story a couple of years ago in Rolling Stone. It was a significant story specifically about Sergeant Bergdahl. So the stories that are coming out and the questions about what he did and why he did what he did, these are not news. So again, I think I want to get just back to you on the stage, the optics of the White House appearance with the parents. I mean, is that something that was repulsive to you, Art?
No, it wasn't repulsive. They have publicly been appealing for the release of their son and have appealed directly to the president. There's a church in Chicago not far from here I go to with some regularity, though not frequently. It's very much an older congregation, and the pastor there and the congregation have been praying for Bergdahl along with others in need for quite a while. It has been very much a public subject.
It has been stated and over again that it is U.S. policy and tradition that we don't leave a soldier behind. If you have served in the military, you also know that if you are taken into captivity, you're to give name, rank, and serial number. And as I said last week, I'm not going to second guess anyone as to what they would do when once being held captive. We can only think that we would maybe act differently, but we don't really know that. In likelihood, we probably wouldn't in many cases. But the other thing that you're taught is you don't desert your post. It seems to me there may be some controversy about what he did and when he did it. But under the definition of desertion, I don't know how anyone could think that he was not a deserter, because he did turn his back. He walked out of that compound. He turned his back on his comrades. And some would say he turned his back on his country. And yet we are holding him to the same level of that somehow he has earned the responsibility of the army and the military forces to go in and get him when he somewhat kicked that behind. John?
He left behind his weapon and his body armor. He took only his personal belongings. He's been quoted saying, "I'm ashamed to be an American." It's reported that he converted to Islam and declared himself to be an Islamic freedom fighter. This story just gets worse and worse as it goes along. And I think that he may be anything up to and including a traitor. We don't know. I'm not making that accusation, but certainly those questions have been raised by his fellow soldiers. And leaving your post in time of combat is a very serious infraction.
You know, Charles, we're learning about a lot of these things from the press, but the White House should have been able to immediately access the reports that had been done. There had been a thorough investigation of this by the military itself. That was available to the White House.
But there is no indication that they didn't know that.
That's correct.
I mean, they didn't. What you're sort of suggesting, I think, is if they knew all this, why would they make such a big deal?
That's an interesting point. I think part of the answer may be that for all the talk at the very beginning of the presidency about a team of rivals with a lot of dissenting voices, we really don't have a lot of dissenting voices, and we have the worst relationship between a president and Capitol Hill in 30 or 40 years. So this president did not get good advice and then made a bad decision.
When we come back, I want to talk more about the relationship with Congress and some things that Senator Dianne Feinstein said today about the trade. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. Give us a buzz. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for being with us tonight. 1-800-723-8289. We're talking about the Bergdahl Taliban trade and your reaction to it. 1-800-723-8289. Before the break, Charles was making the point about that the president didn't inform Congress. Under the law, he is supposed to give them 30 days notice. And the heads of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, including Dianne Feinstein, who has been a big supporter of the administration for the most part. She criticized him for not letting the Congress know, chastised him quite a bit when she was on Face the Nation today. On that particular point, isn't it clear that the president did violate the law, Art?
No. Historically, we've given considerable leeway to the president in foreign policy especially. Technically, doing my research, he did put a signing statement on the law, a practice that Ronald Reagan started and George W. Bush carried much further, saying he didn't accept that provision. I don't think this rises to an impeachable offense. I am very glad, however, Bruce, that you are turning the discussion to policy issues. I think there's a very good chance that Bergdahl had a mental breakdown, which happens a lot to people in combat. It reminds me very much of a case by Robert Garwood during the Vietnam War, which we can discuss if you want. But I urge this group, we're not Fox News types, and I think we're above the usual media warriors who have been commenting on this matter. I think we should be discussing policy rather than this particular personality, and thank you for moving us that way.
Well, but part of the policy here is, according to at least what I have read thus far, that the law specifically says for the release of detainees at Guantanamo, Congress is supposed to receive a 30-day notice. That did not happen, and the president did not have confidence in his own leadership team in the House and Senate, his representatives there, and that's why Dianne Feinstein is upset. John, I mean, does Dianne Feinstein have a legitimate beef here?
Yeah,
and
probably,
is this really bipartisan
she probably
in
has
questioning
a,
the White
she
House?
She probably has a legitimate beef because she's speaking for the Senate, and the Senate is sort of the scorned woman in this particular case. But from
Be careful with that imagery nowadays.
That's true. From the president's perspective, though, he's commander-in-chief, and he sees, as he indicated in that signing statement that you referred to, latitude in these transactional matters. And this is one of those foggy areas. Now, I don't know that anybody been talking about it as impeachable offense, really? I mean,
Republicans.
The word is charged.
Absolutely.
John, listen to them.
And that's what makes it serious. And that's what makes it serious.
This law may indeed be an unconstitutional infringement on the powers of the president as commander-in-chief. And I'm second to none in my respect for the inherent powers of the presidency in terms of national defense and foreign policy. That being said, the law is currently on the books, and the president seems to take the position that he will abide by the law except when it's inconvenient. And when it's inconvenient, he'll just disregard it.
Well, there were some exigencies in this particular case, the perception that his health was, that this was
an emergency. That's been largely knocked down. There's no indication that there's
not been knocked down.
We don't know.
We don't know.
We can't.
But we have to rely, as I think you would, as a academic, we have to rely on the information that we have brought to us by reliable news sources. And today, according to the New York Times, which I think is a publication that you would generally agree with the quality of their reporting, they are reporting on the medical condition of Sergeant Bergdahl. He was indeed locked in a metal cage in total darkness for a week, and for weeks. So there's no one wants to play that down. Doctors now say that he is physically able to travel, but not yet emotionally ready to travel. He remains in a German hospital where he's being inspected by U.S. doctors. However, this report says that Sergeant Bergdahl shows few, if any, of the signs of the malnutrition and other ailments that the Obama administration officials said he was suffering when they saw a video of him that the Taliban made available last December and released a month later. So they're dealing with video that was shot in January, and yet he is now in the hands of U.S. doctors who are saying there was no sign that his life was about to end or be in any danger, which was the justification that they used and was given to the American people by, Susan Rice, we know her, last week on the Sunday show.
Bruce, Dianne Feinstein also said today that she's seen no evidence that his health was in imminent danger. The problem has been that they can't get their story straight at the White House. They come up with several different stories. They had to move very quickly. That was because the health was in danger. That was also why they couldn't notify Congress. I actually agree with Art and John's point that the law restricting the president in this case might well be unconstitutional. But it seems to me that they have damaged their credibility so badly over so many cases that when they tell you anything, it has little, if any, informational value. We simply, I agree with you, Art, we don't know a lot of things, but what we do know is that the administration's spin on all of this means that when they tell you that Bo Bergdahl was very sick and they had to get him out, you should give that almost no credence at all.
Yeah, but if he'd wound up with his head cut off on the streets of Kabul, there'd be all kind of attacks on the administration for not being more assertive. Why don't we stick to policy?
You're talking about the conversations of Fox News. I mean, isn't that a little hyperbolic?
Absolutely.
I mean, have his head cut off? You're repeating what John Kerry said. What evidence do we have?
I didn't realize that John Kerry had said that.
What evidence do we have that they were going to cut his head off?
Well, I'm in good company if that's the kind of... We don't know. What I'm saying is this is a situation that was highly volatile, and we're not only armchair warriors, we're Monday morning quarterbacks on this. I'm not defending the White House, but I think we should move the discussion away from kicking around this poor bastard who's been released to talking about the policy issues.
It's not about Bergdahl.
That's what we've been talking about.
We're talking about the White House's decision.
White House has knowledge. I would assume that this White House had knowledge of Bergdahl's background before they chose to go the extra mile and agree to take all the heat that they assumed they were going to take when they were trading him for five significant, some of whom have been described as mass murderers, who were released from Guantanamo. They had to know that something was going to hit the fan. They set up this event photo op at the White House because they wanted to get some mileage out of it. They knew things were going to hit the fan. Maybe they didn't know that within 48 hours, those people that served with Sergeant Bergdahl described him as a deserter and with all corroborating stories about what sort of a guy he was. And the bigger question is, does it set a precedent? Which is one of the other concerns. The precedent, there's several reasons why people are upset. Congress is upset because they weren't given the information. The members of the military, many, are fearful and upset because they think he's a deserter and not a hero. And then you add to that, which again, this gets back to just a complete, almost an ignorance on the part of the administration when they send out Susan Rice last week. And she says on national television what a joyous day it was, that he served with honor and distinction. Now, based on everything I've read, there's nothing that would indicate that Bergdahl served with honor and distinction. So that's taking what military people are taught from the moment they go into the military. It's taking that and it's rubbing their nose in it. I mean, he did not serve with honor and distinction. Now, that doesn't mean he should have been left behind, but I certainly don't think it means he should have been traded for five combat warriors who want to go back, two of whom have already announced that they're going back in the war against the United States.
You've raised a very good question of Guantanamo, and I hope we do spend some time on that and what we're going to do with the people who are still there. That's a very good policy question.
John.
Let me just say, you know, those are excellent points that you've made, and this administration followed what seems to be its standard operating procedure. When you get into a foreign policy bind, you send Susan Rice out so that she can really screw things up. That point having been made, the second thing I want to say is we've been commemorating the D-Day invasion. Remember that there were thousands of American GIs that were captured in the opening weeks of World War II in the Philippines, on Guam, on Wake Island, and they spent the next 3 years and more in deplorable conditions in Japanese prison camps, many of them survivors of the Bataan Death March. No effort was made in wartime to bring them back. There were no prisoner exchanges during World War II.
We had
Union troops that were in horrible conditions at Andersonville Prison during the Civil War, and Ulysses S. Grant ended prisoner exchanges because of the manner in which the South was treating black Union troops. So the idea that we go the extra mile and do whatever is necessary, that really has not been the history of the United States in recent conflicts.
John McDonough, your comment.
First of all, World War II was a state of total war. Complete mobilization on the part of this country. Unconditional surrender was the only terms on which it could be ended. To talk about prisoner exchanges during the course of that war and to associate them with a war that is winding down in Afghanistan doesn't seem to, you know, balance out to me.
I just want to make a point. This is another thing that's driving me crazy. They talk about winding down the war. First of all, according even to the administration, there's going to be U.S. troops there for a couple more years. Now, maybe they're not going to be engaged in combat, mm-hmm. but this war is not over.
No.
It's not over for the Afghan people. And the war that we should be talking about is the war that we are fighting, which, as I said last week, is going to be the longest war in the history of this country. And that's the war on terror. The five guys that were released, they were not involved in the Afghan war. They were involved in the war against the United States and against our way of life, and they're soldiers in the war on terror. That exists. That's not going away.
And a very marginal war it was, wasn't it?
1-800-723-8289. Mm-hmm. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly. From Spokane, Washington to Houston, Texas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Four great guests around the roundtable, and they're going to introduce themselves right now, starting with Charles Lipson.
Hi. I teach at the University of Chicago. I teach mostly international politics. I've been writing a monthly column for the Chicago Tribune as well. And I started doing this when Marconi was still the engineer in the back room, Bruce.
Art Sear.
I'm from Carthage College. I teach international political economy. Carthage is in Kenosha, Wisconsin, just across the border, and run the Clausen Center, our international center. Tom Clausen is one of our graduates who ran Bank of America and the World Bank.
John McDonough.
I do some teaching at Northwestern University, occasionally contribute to National Public Radio, mostly historical pieces. Worked with Bob Trout, Walter Cronkite for a number of years on the NPR pieces, and with great pleasure.
John Kochelko.
Well, I was in local government in the town of Cicero for many years, served in the Illinois General Assembly. I enjoy doing public speaking and political commentary. In fact, I'm going to be portraying Sherlock Holmes this Thursday at an event out in LaGrange, and I'm looking forward to doing
that. You look a little like Sherlock Holmes.
Thank you. I appreciate the compliment.
And I would have you do a little bit of Sherlock Holmes, but no one would know whether it was really good or bad or not.
Right.
It sounded like Henny Youngman, and that's how Sherlock Holmes sounded. Before we continue and take some more calls, let me remind you that on the 21st of June, we're having a major benefit for the Museum of Broadcast Communications. It will be a salute to Dick Cavett. Salute to Dick Cavett, Saturday night, June 21st, 6:30 at night. Black tie is optional. Tickets are only $125. It helps the museum and our programs throughout the year. And again, it's going to be a great night, and that will be followed by 3-month retrospective on Dick Cavett. We have all of these great shows from the 70s and 80s that have arrived here at the museum, and that will be going on for 3 months. But again, June 21st, Dick Cavett in person in Chicago, your opportunity to come down. Go to museum.tv, museum.tv for tickets, or if you want to take a chance on the raffle, we got a great raffle as well. Head there and take a look and see if you can help the museum. Let's go.
One of the things that Dick Cavett show was so wonderful about, and I'm so glad you've got these, is that Dick Cavett loved the old movie stars, the old comedians.
Yes.
And so there were people like Groucho Marx who were really in their final years but had many memories. They were still all there.
Yep.
And those shows are just invaluable.
Well,
they really are.
They will be screened on a regular basis starting on the 24th of June. Let's go to the telephone calls. Let's go to Dave, who's listening to us in Spokane, Washington on KXLY. Go ahead, Dave.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen. Just a quick narrative to give you some background for me that goes context to my comment. I was a major, a pilot in the Marine Corps. I was also forward air controller with the battalion, and as such, I was involved in various strategic planning missions. You know, we determined what type of a mission to execute, heliborne, mechanized, amphibious, go, no-go criteria, et cetera. And I pride myself on being an objective, critical thinker. I'm an independent, and it upsets me when I see people trying to politicize this into a, red, blue thing, those terrible conservatives or Republicans or anybody that's questioning this administration. This should be a red, white, and blue thing, and here's some of my concerns. One, you've got the health concern issue brought up originally, which come to find out maybe it's not so much a health concern. So what do we fall back on? Well, his life was in danger. As if it wasn't in danger 3, 6 months ago, a year ago, or 3 years ago. And then you fall back to, well, don't leave someone behind, which is particularly irritating to me because, as I said, from a strategic planning perspective, it's not leave no one behind, period, full stop, like the president said. There's all kinds of decisions that have to go into that, whether it's as easy as weather and night illumination, you know, terrain, enemy threats. There's all sorts of things we consider. So it's not just that at all costs you're not going to go rescue somebody. And for a real quick example, for the people out there that think I'm, you know, inhumane for thinking, well, maybe we would have said no to a decision, if you were given the option of, hey, here's a guy with a machete to his neck, and I know that wasn't the case here, but you're on a teleconference and the demand is, you know, $1 trillion, or the demand is an aircraft carrier, or this is going to happen. Obviously, at some point, you say no. And there's a very serious process that has to go through on weighing national security, for one, and the risk of the rest of the Marines that are, well, all of our forces that are still over there, versus rescuing one individual. So it really irritates me when we drive this to a leave no one behind, period, type of a statement. So, I mean, another thing is we have this issue of, well, we were going to release him anyway. That's the new narrative, so why not get something for him? Well, I'm sorry, but we don't know what we're going to do in the future. Anything could happen over the next few weeks that could totally change our strategy and what we're going to do in that theater. And so you can't just say, well, we know we're going to do that. And guess what? The people who are still deployed and stationed there, to them, the war is still going on. So don't tell me the war is winding down, because if you're still stationed over there, the war is still very much in your backyard. And you can't say, well, these guys are going to be in Qatar for a whole year. Well, hopefully that's the case. But even if that's the case, I'm not worried about these five guys putting a pack on and going out in the field. I'm worried about their strategic planning operations, which they can do perfectly fine from Qatar and transfer to the people in the field. And those missions can then be executed against people who are, again, currently in the field. So, those are some of my concerns.
David, stay on the line. I want to get Art Sear. Well, we're going to give everyone an opportunity to respond. Art Sear, you first. Your response to what David has to say.
No one here is going to be defending the way the White House has handled this. You mentioned the Korean War initially, and I appreciate the compliment. That war was particularly destructive in terms of our fixation with POWs. Approximately 20 American POWs and one British decided to stay in the North, and accusations, mostly wildly exaggerated, of brainwashing really have poisoned, literally, American politics for some years thereafter, and I think that continues to resonate. It's why we tend to become more emotional, probably, than we should be about the POW issue, but it's always been important in the U.S. Nixon getting the POWs home was vital,
John,
during Vietnam.
In your view, following up on what David said, if you're a leader of the Taliban, mm-hmm. and you've just pulled off this big trade, and you have two of your leading strategists already saying that they're going to return to the field of mm-hmm. battle. And following up on what Dave said, they may be able to be thinking and doing these things when they're allegedly under arrest in mm-hmm. Qatar. Do you understand that because this is now known by everyone throughout the world, doesn't it put every American, whether they're a soldier or a NGO operator or a tourist, doesn't it put them at risk of being snatched up? Because one of the major ways in which Al-Qaeda has kept raising money is through kidnapping and ransoms.
You're suggesting that this incident has suddenly given our enemy the idea that if they capture prisoners, they can hold them for some sort of return? I think they'd thought of that before.
For a 5-to-1 deal.
A 5-to-1. You know, an awful lot of there's been an awful lot of talk about these five Taliban leaders who, in actual fact, may be, aside from their symbolic significance, totally worthless. They've been in isolation for 12 years. Suppose General MacArthur had been kidnapped. You talk about the Korean War in 1938.
They've been leaders, by the way. In Guantanamo, they have been leaders. They've been viewed as leaders.
They've been in isolation at Guantanamo. They've been off the battlefield. They are worthless. They are worthless to anything that's relevant to the contemporary struggle.
But let's deal with the facts. They're not in isolation. They're in a general area where they have recreation. Mm-hmm. They have access to 100 DirecTV cable channels. Mm-hmm. They're not in isolation.
They get on the internet every day and communicate
They do not get on the internet. Okay. But within this has been reported, again, by U.S. officials, the people in charge at Guantanamo. They say that two of these five guys were very active in basically being barn bosses within the rest of the troops down.
Fine. What does that mean in terms of their ability to go back and be a meaningful, play a meaningful combat role in Afghanistan?
It means that at one point they were identified as, because they were involved more than two were involved in the planning of 9/11. They think that they will go back on the battlefield and they will use their skills and their organizational skills. Now they have the added value of being sort of heroic, because they survived Guantanamo.
Okay, their symbolic significance stands, but
they're going to spend a year in a prison, allegedly not being able to communicate and not being able to do anything. These are not young men, so they're not going to go out and do the battles. But strategically, they're going to be there.
Well, suppose
let's get John's
symbolism is important. Our enemies are not treating them as worthless. They are treating this as a great victory, and symbolism means a great deal. They attacked the World Trade Center because of symbolism. They attacked the Pentagon because of symbolism. They understand the meaning of that. And we've now established a rate of exchange, 5-for-1, which is a very lucrative arrangement if you're a terrorist.
Maybe the right analogy is to mafia bosses that have been held in prison for 10 or 12 years. And when they reenter, even though they may not know all the details of the way that the operation is running now, they'll come back up to speed. These are strategists. These are at the general level. I think the big political risk for the White House is twofold, besides what's happening now. If there are any hostages taken by jihadi groups around the world, and they publicly link it to the fact when that happens, the White House will be in a very difficult position. And the second thing is that when these people return, they will be associated, perhaps fraudulently associated, with attacks either on the Afghan government or on our troops or on both. When that happens, once again, the White House is going to be in a very awkward position.
John Kerry said today that he did not, that if they are in prison, and even when they get out of prison, it isn't just the Qataris that are going to be watching over them, that the United States is going to be keeping, or that someone, they're being watched, is what he said. They're going to be watched. And he does not believe that when they get out, that if they choose to enter the battlefield, they will run the risk of what happens to anyone when they get on the battlefield. So it seems to me that at least John Kerry is suggesting that these guys are being marked, and maybe the moment they step out of that prison, they're going to be droned. They will be droned. He's certainly suggesting.
You mean we kill people with drones?
Well, I think that's what John Kerry at least hinted today, in the way in which he said the conversation that the president is not going to do anything that basically allows those people to kill more Americans. Back shortly, 1-800-723-8289. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's head to Houston, Texas, where Bobby is listening to us on KLBJ out of Austin. Go ahead, Bobby.
Hey, good show tonight.
I just wanted to
say that the timing is completely off with the Bergdahl release. He could have been released any time. And I strongly believe that the administration knew that Bergdahl was a deserter. And to do this, you know, basically 1 week or the week of the 70th anniversary of D-Day is a slap in the face to every World War II veteran and any veteran served in any war or anyone currently serving in the armed forces. Slap in the face.
John Kochelko, do you agree with that?
I certainly tend to agree with that, that it was something that came, the timing of it was horrible, happening in this same week in which we're commemorating the heroism of those that landed at Normandy, the way in which it was oversold, The fact that they should have known at least the allegations and questions regarding this man, and that should have worked against throwing this triumphal.
But they had to know that.
Of course they had to know.
I think that's got to be a given. They had to know that.
Someone said, well, you know, the president was leaving to go to Europe, so they had to do it over the weekend. They were in a rush to get his photo op. I think this was a PR-driven event. They wanted that weekend event so that they could have it on the Sunday morning news shows with the president celebrating his another of his glorious achievements in the realm of foreign policy.
John McDonough.
Well, the caller uses the word deserter as if there's no question or doubt, and I think a great deal of doubt surrounds that assertion. It's just an assertion at this point that he was a deserter. You made a point earlier about him wandering off post or leaving post. There's a difference between leaving your post and deserting and going over to the enemy and becoming a traitor.
Desertion can be leaving your post.
Desertion doesn't require going over to the enemy.
I've not said that he was a traitor. I've not used that term. I don't care if he has changed his religion. I don't care about that. I don't care if his father has a beard.
We don't know whether he was left his post.
But we do know there's nothing that says in the military code of conduct that says you can leave your post, but if there's some moral reason, you can leave your post. It says, it's very clear, you don't leave your post.
Well, of course, yes.
And the people that were there that were left behind, many of whom began to look for him, some of whom have died, some of whom had died in the search, they feel
that's correct.
But they feel that they were betrayed, and the story that was written a couple of years ago in Rolling Stone, no right wing rag, painted a picture of someone who clearly was deserting his country, said derogatory things about his country, and one would have to be blind to not think that the least thing that you would agree on is the guy deserted his post.
Well, if he was going over to the other side, he wasn't treated very well, apparently, according to the New York Times article you just quoted a few minutes ago.
That's because he tried to escape.
Information point, Rolling Stone is a very anti-military publication. I'm not defending Bergdahl or anybody else, but it's a useful publication, but they are extremely anti-military. They did in Stanley McChrystal. He did it himself by being dumb enough to talk to these people. It's almost unbelievable, but that is not an unbiased, objective publication.
What is your point, though?
Rolling Stone is an interesting and useful publication, but they are anti-military, and what they write is from an anti-military bias.
So describing him as a deserter was what, to play to their constituency and to their readers?
I don't know.
Missing your point, Art.
My point is, it's not the New York Times. It's not even the Wall Street Journal. It is not an objective publication, Bruce. So their material may or may not be factually true, but there is a bias against the military in Rolling Stone.
Do you think, however, that the men who served with him, do you think there's some conspiracy that they're telling basically the same story about what happened?
No, I didn't say that at all. I'm saying that the source that you're quoting is one to be used with considerable caution and care.
First of all, all the men he served with have said that he voluntarily went away from his post. That's desertion, and it's desertion in time of war. Secondly, we know that there's been an extensive military investigation of this. That's been kept closed. But I want you to ask yourself, if that, given the president's exposure on this, now that he's welcomed the family home in a kind of mission accomplished moment, if that report benefited the president, do you think that we wouldn't have heard some leak about it? That I'm not saying he's a traitor. It does, however, seem just unambiguous to me, at least, that he left his post voluntarily. That's desertion.
It's certainly not to come back.
It is certainly not. His conduct is certainly not something that should be described by the National Security Advisor as an honorable action.
She wasn't referring to that act of wandering off post. She said he served with dignity and honor. Now all she's saying is he enrolled, and that was dignity.
Susan Rice said that he served with honor and distinction.
Mm-hmm. Honor and distinction.
That's a slap in the face to everyone in the armed services.
I think the use of that term is indicative of a president and Susan Rice, the National Security Advisor, who have no clue about the military mind.
I think she was just probably using boilerplate rhetoric that she
used. But she could have walked it back now.
She's talking about American soldiers who volunteered for service.
It's the State Department.
And she did not think through the
That's the problem. You know. Susan Rice doesn't think through anything. I do not sleep comfortably at night knowing that Susan Rice is the national security advisor to the President of the United States.
And was his choice for Secretary of State.
When you put her on television, in my view, you're leading with a bad choice to go out and represent your story. She has a history of, if not lying, at least misleading the American people. You don't send her out again. When Susan Rice's lips are moving,
This is the first time. Let's discount Benghazi.
Why
she's
discount
probably
Benghazi?
Not,
because it doesn't mean anything.
I'm not going to.
It doesn't mean anything. What difference does it make?
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8229. This gang will continue for another full hour taking calls at 1-800-723-8229. Where do you come down on this controversy? We've got callers waiting on the line. If you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. If you're listening to us on radio, we're going to pause for a little network news. Then back on the other side with a full hour of Beyond the Beltway live from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Gentlemen, Dick Cavett.
He's one of the greatest television interviewers of all time. The legendary Dick Cavett is coming to Chicago.
There's a certain excitement in the air.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications presents a salute to Dick Cavett, Saturday, June 21st at 6:30.
But this is me. I'm letting it all hang out.
Spend an evening with a television legend.
Why don't we see how the show is?
A salute to Dick Cavett. Go to museum.tv for your tickets now.
Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Art Sear of Carthage College, historian and lecturer John Kochelko, Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago, and writer and NPR contributor John McDonough. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. If you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it's beyondthebeltway.com. And if you'd like to tweet us a question, it's @Dumo, @DUMO, and we'll take your tweets as well. We've been talking about the exchange of Sergeant Bergdahl with the Taliban, five Taliban terrorists going the other way, and the controversy involving that. That has been part of our discussion this evening. We have a lot of callers that have already called in on that subject. They've been standing by, so we're going to go to them right now. And we begin with Mike listening to us on our flagship station, WLS, from Chicago in Joliet. Go ahead.
I just have one comment to say. Well, actually, kind of varies. I'm a retired Marine Corps gunnery sergeant, combat vet. And thing is, he's an Army vet or an Army NCO, and the thing is, you don't walk out of your forward operating base without your weapon or anything else on you. So he was looking for somebody. And I'll also say one thing that won't go over very well, and that saw his mom and dad on TV, and dad had a long beard. So are they Islamic? I don't know.
Well, let me ask you this.
Okay.
Why is that important that his father has a beard?
No, you're detracting from what I said.
All right, then clarify.
He's an Army NCO. He walked away without his weapon or anything else. Nobody in their right mind. I could see maybe a private doing something stupid like that, but not an NCO, whether it's Army, Marine Corps. Definitely not Marine Corps.
Mike, I'm going to John Kuchelka, do you want to weigh in on this?
Well, just to say that we don't know what happened in terms of his mind, why he did what he did. The Army is going to investigate that. And if they find sufficient grounds, I would expect there to be a court-martial. And I think they made it very clear that a court-martial is on the table if they find evidence that that he violated the military code, that he was, in fact, a deserter, or worse. But until we know, I think it's reasonable to be a little circumspect and to let the investigation go forward.
John,
my problem is with the White House's exaltation of this event, the way they presented it, and the trade
day.
Of five for one.
Well, John, that is as good a summation as I've heard of everything we actually know right now. Nothing more to say.
Art Sear, your response.
You brought up Fox News earlier. Bob Woodward is a very durable, I will confess to watching Fox once in a while, Bob Woodward, the very durable and insightful journalist and also a Navy veteran from the Vietnam era, made the very good point that not only don't we know what's going on, but also this White House seems remarkably isolated. Now, going back to Watergate, this guy has had remarkable access and has been remarkably credible for many years.
Mike, thank you very much for your call. Let's move to Bob, listening to us in Grand Rapids, Michigan, also on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead.
That way.
Go ahead. Bob, are you there?
Hey, Bob.
Bob, are you there on line five in Grand Rapids? Going once, going twice, are you there?
Might be on me.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Might be with Mike still. And I can't say anything
He's talking to himself.
Bob, do you know that you're talking to us live on the radio right now? I don't think he does. So let's go to Paul. Perhaps he is ready to go. Are you listening to us, Paul? And go ahead.
I'm ready, willing, and able.
Good.
So far, to Chuck's point, the inverse, that no soldier that has served with this guy has come out to defend him. And number two, a couple weeks ago at West Point, President Obama said that we are an exceptional nation because we live up to international laws and norms. These five terrorists were wanted by the International Criminal Court and the UN Human Rights Commission. Why didn't we live up to those norms and give these over to the International Criminal Court at The Hague for them to stand trial for the thousands that they murdered in Afghanistan, the civilians that they murdered in Afghanistan?
I think that one or two were wanted. Two of them were wanted for large-scale crimes.
In war crimes.
One case, the large killing of a large number of Shia Muslims in Afghanistan before 9/11 when the Taliban had control. Yes, we could have turned them over, but the point was the president wanted to get back our captive soldier. That's the reason they didn't do it. I've got to say that you don't hear much about international law from the administration anymore, and you certainly don't hear anything about responsibility to protect, sometimes called R2P, after Libya, because we went in the case of Libya, saying that 1,000 or more people could be shelled and could die there, but we've over 160,000 people have now died in Syria. So I think
Syria was much worse, excuse me, but that's a very important point.
Yeah, I mean, the Syrian case is just awful, and the fact is we haven't been willing to do anything on that, so I just think that international law falls by the wayside here.
We're going to take another call. We're going to go to Palm Springs, California. Bob is listening to us on KTPR, our first call from Palm Springs. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm on the air from Palm Springs.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, great. Yeah, in the Jewish religion, if you save one life, you save the world. Whatever people may say about what this guy did or he didn't do, the fact is President Obama saved the life of this one soldier, and according to the Jewish religion, which the Christian religion is based upon, he saved everyone in the U.S. Army by doing this. And I applaud the president for putting on the mindset of someone who's Jewish. I think it's great that the president now is thinking according to the highest morals of the Judeo-Christian religion. I think it's terrific.
Charles. He never actually uses the term Judeo-Christian. I've wanted to get a full database of his speeches. It's not a term he ever uses. But in fact, I know the phrase where if you save one person, you save the world. And I haven't heard anybody here say that they didn't want to get that soldier back. I think what people have objected to are the terms of the deal, the timing of the deal when we still have soldiers there for the next 2 years, the process by which they cut out a lot of people in the Congress they could have gotten feedback, and the celebratory character of the deal. So I take your point. I think that reasonable people can differ here.
Bob, thanks very much for your call. Nice to hear from Palm Springs, 1-800-723-8029. The calls are coming in. We will continue from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining. John, you were making a point during the break about John McDonough. You had made the point that you think Bergdahl is being smeared.
Well, we were talking about it seems to be a smear contest between Fox and the New York Times or the MSNBC.
It's unique. You've got Fox and the New York Times both, as you say, smearing him.
No.
Is it about the smear that you define as a smear?
Well, I mean, the idea that he has been convicted of being a deserter and a traitor and anti-American.
He has not been convicted in the court of public opinion.
The other night, I remember Sean Hannity showing pictures of Bergdahl in his ballet costume, suggesting subliminally to his audience what we can all probably imagine.
I simply said that when you're quoted saying I am ashamed to be an American and refer to the U.S. Army as an organization of fools, you're going to expect some pushback from people. I'm not upset by the fact that people are unhappy when someone says that they're ashamed to be an American.
I think it's really shameful what the administration has done to the other soldiers in the unit. They did not sort of push themselves immediately forward. They were called by people. They've consistently said the same thing. All of them have said it. Nobody has challenged it. I haven't heard anybody challenge it. The closest anybody has come is to say we don't know everything, much like what you were saying.
Donna Brazile said on CNN today, she said, well, that's just part of the Republican stirring
smear
up the crowd.
Yeah.
I mean, that was
President Obama is saying, you know,
nothing surprises
conspiracy. Me, you know, this
right-wing
stirred up in Washington.
It has been politicized, and it's not by coincidence.
Who do you think politicized it?
The president.
I have this is in the Department of Rumor and Innuendo, which this show has thrived on for many years. I remember a reporter talking the other a week or so ago about the fact that this group of soldiers that have been speaking out about their experience has been organized by a public relations company in this country, very much in the same way that the PR department of J. Walter Thompson, you know, organized some of the publicity back in the 1991 about the first Iraq war, that they were breaking in and, you know, taking babies out of
the Kuwait thing.
There was a public relations organization behind that push. They were working on behalf of the Kuwait government in order to build opinion. And I had heard that there is a public relations company behind some of that in this country. That doesn't mean it's not true.
Make it untrue.
I just want to say I think this administration has become so accustomed to being treated by the national media by having them serve as cheerleaders for the administration, that they really resent any pushback or any criticism from anybody. They think they're above that. They think they can walk on water. They think they can do whatever they want and get away with it because the media is on their side. And this isn't a case where that's not working. Mm-hmm. And they're not taking it very well.
The VA, it didn't work either.
And they don't deal with that very well. The president just keeps saying period over and over again.
Let's go to Dave in Joliet, Illinois on WLS. Go ahead, Dave. You're on the air. Yes.
Bruce, don't you think that if Barack Obama had done nothing and they killed this guy, he'd been condemned for doing nothing to help him?
I think that's right. Mm-hmm. I think that's absolutely right. The president of the United States is responsible for the safety of soldiers, even if they desert. Mrs. Clinton is ultimately elected, she will be responsible. They're responsible for putting people in harm's way, and I'm sure the president takes that very seriously. It's a good point, sir.
Beverly in Dalton, Illinois on WLS. Go ahead, Beverly. Beverly, are you there? Beverly, are you there? We're having a hard time with our phone calls tonight, guys. Let's see if we can shape it up down there. Charlotte in Arlington Heights. Are you there?
I'm here.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I'm getting an echo. There may be another PR problem with the White House. Bridget Gabriel commented, do you know what the father's prayer was, the senior Bergdahl on the steps of the White House Rose Garden?
No, I don't.
According to Bridget Gabriel, who was on a nationwide talk show, it was a prayer of Muslim conquest. They planted the flag, and this is recognized, according to her, around the world for hundreds of years, 1,400 years. If that is true, how do we look to the rest of the world?
I'm prepared to cut a fair amount of slack to the parents themselves. Yes, yeah. They've been under incredible stress. They have a child who's been taken. I think that the adults in the room that have to be held responsible to the President of the United States for holding a big event with them instead of having a private meeting in the Oval Office and then himself going out and saying that this is a day we are glad to say that we're bringing someone home and it will be up to the military to determine the circumstances under which he's taken, and that would have been a heck of a lot better than what they did.
Also, I do believe that in this particular case, because Sean Hannity's name was brought up, and I brought up Bill O'Reilly a little bit earlier, I think it is a disservice to a discussion of this issue when you have people that are either making comments about the father, about the prayer that he gave, about his questioning his motives, questioning that how long his beard is, that he looks like a Muslim. That's an idiotic statement to make. And also the comments, as John suggested, trying to besmirch by going beyond the pale, in my view, of Sergeant Bergdahl. I think there's enough basic information that we know about Sergeant Bergdahl. If we just read, the Rolling Stone magazine, and without the investigation, and it will come, as to whether or not he deserves to be court-martialed, there's enough basic information, and it comes down to one thing. Did he leave his post? If he left his post, he deserted his post. And those people that were behind, I think their testimony is worth a great deal. You don't have to go beyond just the basic facts that I think we know about this in this particular case. And by the way, I will say that they are facts in the fact that we do know that he left his post and he was captured by the Taliban.
What was his intent? What was his intent?
That's right.
What was his intent when he left his post?
But the point is, John, the intent is something we're not going to know until we hear from Bergdahl. Right. But there's nothing in the Code of Military Conduct that talks about intent. You either do it or you don't. You either stand by your post. You don't leave your post, period. You certainly don't leave your post without your weapon. You don't wander off with three things and basically leave all your military. That's certainly, would you acknowledge, that's at least questionable behavior.
Of course it's questionable, it's not necessarily desertion. He was captured, apparently, without it being intended to be captured.
But was he captured?
Well, of course, no one goes out there because they want to be captured. Because at this particular point, again, whether it was his state of mind, he thought he was ready to leave where he was, mm-hmm. turn his back on what his duty was. He swore to you know, follow the military code of conduct. You don't get through basic training without doing that. You don't leave your post. Period.
Okay, but if there's
that's not ambiguous.
The reason they call it desertion is because he deserted.
If he left his post with the intention of leaving the military in that particular location, what sane person would leave, you know, the protection of a military base and wander out into hostile countryside?
Well, I'm not going to speculate.
These are all questions.
That would be wrong to speculate on his military state.
Yes, right.
And I'm just stated, I don't think we necessarily, anyone in the media has to deal with some of these ancillary issues, the length of his father's beard. Mm-hmm. Even if he converted to Islam when he was there, that's not an issue. That should not be an issue. Now, if he denounces the United States, and we have that that's part of the permanent record. It's part of the permanent record, and people can either say that someone has the right to change their opinion on the United States. Is that a right of free speech, or do you have to just
not
love
while
America?
You're in the military? Well, you can't do that while you're
these
in
are
the military.
Our things. All right, Art, and then we're going to go to another call.
It's interesting how much time now in total for this taping this evening, an hour and a half of our 2 hours, have been spent on Bergdahl. I brought up Robert Garwood, who disappeared from the Marine base at Da Nang in 65 and reappeared much later. Very similar case, very unpopular, a guy with problems. We didn't obsess with this personality outside of President Carter taking the death penalty off the table when the guy reappeared in Hanoi.
Well, 24-hour table.
We might think about why we're obsessing about this personality.
What's your answer,
who I
Art?
Think is a troubled person. I think it has to do with the fact that we're far more victimized, since we live in a victim culture, especially in academia, by the 24/7 news cycle. In strange ways, we're less mature. We become very self-righteous and sanctimonious about this guy who, in a combat situation, obviously had problems. Beyond that, I don't know. But the military is becoming more and more segregated from the rest of American society, even since the Vietnam era. We didn't obsess about Garwood, who's still around.
Can I just respond to that? I think if the president had done the wise thing, had met with the family in private at the White House, and not associated himself personally with this until we knew all the facts, None of this would have happened. I don't think you would have the kind of controversy. Now, there would be controversy over the failure to notify Congress. There would be controversy over the 5-for-1. But I don't think it would have reached the level that it has. I think that was because of the White House photo op and the triumphalism that surrounded it.
We're going to move on.
That's good.
We have lots of callers. 1-800-723-8229. We'll continue with more callers from Chicago, from coast to coast and border to border every Sunday night. I'm Bruce Dumont. On back. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. We've got great guests around the table, and they are Charles Lipson.
From Marks, Mississippi. You always say I'm the pride of Marks, Mississippi, and I'm indeed proud to be there.
Art Sear.
From Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
And Hollywood High.
Yes, indeed.
And
Hollywood
UCLA.
High.
Let's give
were there any stars there when you were there?
Who? Yes. Swoosie Kurtz went on to some success. Ooh. On Broadway and on TV, and
children of famous
I moved
people?
In different circles, but there was a very attractive young lady, Mimsy Farmer, who kind of flamed.
I went to Nutrier High School when Anne Margaret was there. I want you
really?
To know. So
also,
and I have just to buttress my other credentials here. I wrote for the Wall Street Journal for about 25 years, contributed to NPR, and that's my CV. Moment.
John Kuchelko.
I'm from the town of Cicero in Illinois, and I always like to say my dad grew up on a farm in Kansas, and my mom grew up in New York City.
Really?
I'm very proud of that.
And how the heck did they end up in Cicero?
And they met in Chicago and settled in Cicero.
And the rest was, and the rest is history.
The rest is history.
A reminder, on June 21st, the Museum of Broadcast Communications is doing a major benefit. It is a salute to Dick Cavett. You're all invited to attend. It's Saturday, June 21st. This is the benefit that supports the ongoing operations of the Museum of Broadcast Communications, where we do this program. Tickets are only $125. There's going to be dancing. There's going to be drinks. There's going to be dinner. It's going to be a great night. Black tie optional. If you want to take your other half of your life out and share a great time downtown, it's a great opportunity to support the museum. You can go to our website, museum.tv, museum.tv, if you want to come to the event. If you go to that website, you're going to find some pretty remarkable raffle prizes as well, if you want to support them that way, if you want to roll the dice a little bit. We're going to go back to calls in just a moment, but again, I should mention that the guests that we have tonight were really originally brought together and selected because we were going to spend virtually the entire program talking about D-Day and the 70th anniversary of it. Obviously, the news of contemporary news is also significant, and so we've spent the vast majority of the program talking about that. But I do want to spend some time talking about the commemoration of the 70th anniversary of D-Day, and I sort of want to put it in context with maybe the issues that we have been discussing. And I'll begin with you, Art, since you are one of our historians that we have on regularly.
Thank you, Bruce.
How would the soldiers of that era, D-Day, how would they feel about the controversy involving the role of soldiers in the military and the president right now, do you think?
I think the basic character of soldiers in warfare doesn't change that much historically. And there are certain historic strengths to the American soldier, including independence, individuality, and an understanding of the wider society that's given us a big advantage historically. So I don't think, well, some of those gentlemen we're still blessed to have with us, you know, they're not terribly surprised by modern society. I don't know if that's helpful, but that's my best answer.
No. Soldiers generally are not called upon to make judgments about policy. The sphere of their world usually is about 12 feet in any direction around them, certainly when they're in combat. And so I think Art is, never having served myself, of course, in the service, this is just a sort of supposition, but I would think that makes a lot of sense.
Right. Do you believe, again, in the context of what we've been talking about tonight, do you believe the soldiers of that generation, do you believe they would have viewed the conduct that we are aware of involving Sergeant Bergdahl? Do you think they would view it as the contemporary soldiers that served with him are viewing it, is that he turned his back and walked away?
It's hard for me to say because these are issues of policy and political conduct, and to confuse the mind of the soldier with the mind of a policymaker or perhaps even in this case a publicist or a PR person is probably not a good equivalent.
John Kochelko, the significance of D-Day and what happened there and whether or not after 70 years the rest of America that was born long after that beach landing, do they understand the significance of what happened 70 years ago?
I hope they do. You know, my father was a combat veteran of the Second World War. I carry his ring that he obtained in the liberation of Manila in 1945.
My dad fought in the Philippines, too.
He served in the landing at the Lingayen Gulf. I think that in years to come, the men who fought and died in World War II are going to be looked upon with awe in the way that we look back on those that served in the Civil War, as well as those that commanded them. I think that the landing at Normandy was the most celebrated event of the European theater, but it was part of this larger story that the United States literally saved humanity in World War II. We did what was supposedly impossible. We fought a war on two fronts against two very powerful, predatory military empires, and we crushed them both. And those who served were indeed the greatest generation. And I think I always like to give credit, and I looked upon as being somewhat perhaps off the marks by some of my conservative brethren, but I think we have to give tremendous credit to their commander-in-chief, to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who led this nation superbly in World War II. I know there's a tendency amongst conservatives today to be highly critical of the New Deal and of FDR, and that's an entirely separate issue. But there was a second act to the Roosevelt administration, and that was World War II. And I think that just as we look back upon Abraham Lincoln as the man who saved the Union, FDR and Winston Churchill were the men who saved the world. And I think we should recognize that in this time.
That's true. I want to connect a couple of things you said. Soldiers often sign up for reasons of patriotism or larger reasons. But when they fight in battle, they're fighting for their buddies. This unit cohesion and small group cohesion, everybody says, is absolutely critical. And I think that that's one of the reasons that you've seen such blowback around the Bergdahl case. This is somebody who abandoned his buddies. I want to say something about World War II, even though my own father fought in the Philippines. The most moving thing that my dad ever showed me about the war was a picture of the bottom of the Golden Gate Bridge as he sailed out under it. And he said, "Charles, I never knew if I would see the United States again." And that could have been my last thought. Down the street from me lives a man named Courtney Wright, a now retired a physicist at the University of Chicago, an Englishman. And I was talking with Courtney a while back, and Courtney was the navigator the day after D-Day who took Dwight Eisenhower over to Normandy. I mean, he lives down the street from me. I just get chills just thinking about it. I mean, it's such an intimate connection with one of the greatest events in history.
Speaking of chills, and longtime listeners to this program will perhaps remember that I've told this story before. Usually it's maybe on an anniversary of this, but I've alluded to this story a number of times because in 1992, when I was actually on my honeymoon, Kathy Osterman and I, we honeymooned in Paris, but we spent a day at Normandy. And I have said before that if I could have a wish, one of my wishes would be that every American could go to Normandy, could watch, to look at those beaches, to walk those beaches, to look at those cliffs, and close your eyes and just think of the hordes of young men who stormed that beach with Germans shooting at them, and looking at that cliff and saying, "My God, how could anyone even get up that hill and get up that cliff with Gatling guns shooting at you, trying to kill you?" And then to walk beyond that and to walk through the streets of that part of France and the reaction that the American troops had, and to go to a museum in Caen, France, which tells the story of World War II from both sides, tells the story of the French resistance, tells the story of the Germans, the German side, the Allied side, a brilliant museum. And then, in addition to walking those beaches, which every once in a while we will see a president walk that beach. Ronald Reagan walked the beach. Bill Clinton walked the beach. Barack Obama has walked the beach. And I would think that any president or anyone that wants to be president should walk that beach. But I wish every American could walk that beach. Because when you think of what happened there, and then you take the moment and you go to the largest cemetery in Europe, and you see thousands of tombstones, the men who lost their lives at Normandy, it is the most solemn experience that I've ever had in my life. And I tell this story periodically because if you're going to Paris, it's great to go to Paris. But take that extra time. Take a day and walk down and walk those beaches. And in many cases, you will not necessarily, you won't find many people that were there in 1944 anymore. But you will run into their sons and their daughters. And from a French perspective, they will talk about the reaction and the love that they have for those Americans and Allied forces that stormed the beaches. We hear a lot about that, you know, we don't like France and France doesn't like us. I can tell you that in that part of France, regardless of who you run into on the street, there is an appreciation for Americans because they realize that someone who I might have known might have stormed the beach, and someone that they might have known might have been in French resistance and might have been part of the welcoming group that cheered the GIs as they began to work their way through the rest of France. So if you get a chance to go, don't ever miss an opportunity to go to the beaches of Normandy. I'll be back shortly. We'll take more calls in a moment. Bruce went back in Chicago. Let's go to calls. We have lots of calls jammed up here. Let's go to Knoxville, Tennessee. Jeff is listening to us on WOKI. Nice to hear from Knoxville tonight. Go ahead.
Yeah, hello, Bruce.
Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to make the point that the big argument, most of the big argument has been about the Congress not being notified before this deal went down last week. And I just want to say that I don't care about that. I don't care about Congress not being notified. Me, the citizen that's been made to bear the brunt of this little war, when you guess called it a marginal war, has not been notified before this little deal went down. And whether Congress was notified or not doesn't matter to me, because I've called my congressmen and my senators, and they have no response to me on any issue anymore. They don't represent me. And as far as I'm concerned, Bruce, this is nothing but aiding the bet and the enemy for the president, and he ought to be impeached, period.
Okay. Let's go to Art to respond to that.
The executive legislative relations going back to Thomas Jefferson have been a defining part of the conflict in American politics. Eisenhower was confronted as soon as he took office with the Bricker Amendment, which was shorthand for enormously powerful efforts, mostly in his own party, for Congress, not the president, to define foreign policy. He had to work like hell and use all his calculating skill and cunning and influence to defeat it. It was defeated by one vote in the Senate, and Ike, on the record but privately while in office, compared it to D-Day in terms of the amount of stress and tension he was under. People weren't literally being killed, but he thought of the beaches at the time, which shows how intense this conflict can be. And the caller reflects, obviously, some of the high emotions that a lot of different Americans, as well as people in Congress,
feel. I agree with your point that I think of all the – and there's about three or four elements of this story that are part of the discussion that's going on, but I would think the one that has the least resonance with the American people, with those that reside beyond the Beltway – which is what this program is about, is the fact that Congress wasn't notified. I think most people, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, their general feeling is, hey, if someone is elected president of the United States, he's commander-in-chief, he's got the executive order, he's got the power, and they also feel that if you tried to tell this to anyone in Congress, there would be there'd be some sort of a leak about it. And I think you'd feel that way whether you're a liberal or Democrat, a liberal or conservative. And I think, when you have someone – but again, having said that, I also understand why – people that are charged with oversight can be a little upset, like Dianne Feinstein is.
I agree with all that. It seems a bit too much like inside baseball, but I would just say the president has had real support from the Democrats in Congress, in both the Senate and the House. And what you've seen over the last month and a half, going alongside with the president's declining popularity, is with the VA scandal and now with the Taliban trade, you see a number of Democrats peeling away from the presidency, and this is bad news for the White House.
Particularly those that are running for re-election this year.
Yes,
Mark,
absolutely.
Mark in Carmel, California, listening to us on KION. Go ahead, Mark.
KION.
Are you there? Go ahead. Are you there? We're having some problems with our phones tonight. Let's go to El Paso, Texas. Nick, listening to us on KTSM.
Yes. Good evening, Bruce.
Yes.
Excellent, excellent program.
Thank you.
Back in the early 70s, early 80s, I was a Lance Corporal stationed at Camp Lejeune when PFC Robert Garwood came back from Vietnam. He was captured outside Da Nang, spent 13 or 14 years in Vietnam, decided to come back to the United States 5 years later of the Operation Homecoming, passed a note to a businessman. He was debriefed, and he was charged and then sentenced, then tried as a court-martial there in Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. He didn't leave the post, but he was captured outside on a jeep.
There's a big dispute about that.
He also collaborated with the enemy. He showed up in North Vietnam, did propaganda tapes against American troops. Then he collaborated with the enemy against American POWs up there. They all came down to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and testified against him. The president needs to keep faith and trust with men and women in the military. Also, the military needs to keep faith and trust. He needs to be debriefed, charged, and then court-martialed and then sentenced, just like Robert Garwood was.
Right, let's go. Art Sears got a comment on that because he brought up Garwood earlier in the broadcast.
Yeah, well, thank you for that very direct information. He has always denied that he collaborated with the enemy. He did say under duress he had contact with other American POWs and continued to argue this became such an intense and poisonous issue through the 70s and 80s that he had seen POWs who were left behind.
Bruce, in Central Illinois, go ahead. You're on the air, our last caller of the night. Bruce, are you there?
Come on, Bruce.
Bruce, are you on line one? Okay,
so I thought
got to get it fixed next week, guys.
The president, the last caller said the president has to keep faith with the military, and of course, the military with him. I think that that was one of the big surprises that came out of all of this. I think that the president and the people around him, his advisors, thought that bringing back a person who'd been held captive would be widely celebrated. First, within the military, we got one of our own back, and then within the country at large. And what's happened has been quite different from what they anticipated. First of all, when you leave your own post, call it desertion, call it something else, when that happens, then people in the military have much more mixed feelings. They do want to have the person back, but they also feel that that person didn't keep faith with his buddies. And secondly,
The White House understood that, or were they?
I think it surprised them.
They've got a tenure.
I think that they've got a 10-year.
They don't know about it.
I think that there are several parts of the White House that have a 10-year, and that was certainly one of them.
John, last word to
you. I don't think they identify with the military ethos. I don't think they think in those terms, and I think there is a certain disdain for some aspects of the military, and that's why they bungled this.
John Kochelko has been with us, Art Sear, John McDonough, and Charles Lipson. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks to Dan Dorfman and Todd Nemel for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dick Cavett.
He's one of the greatest television interviewers of all time. The legendary Dick Cavett is coming to Chicago.
There's a certain excitement in the air.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications presents a salute to Dick Cavett, Saturday, June 21st at 6:30.
But this is me. I'm letting it all hang out.
Spend an evening with a television legend.
Why don't we see how the show is?
A salute to Dick Cavett. Go to museum.tv for your tickets now.